Good evening and welcome to another episode of Nigeria Politics Weekly. We're sorry today's podcast is late. Phoenix, I shouldn't share the blame with myself. Phoenix was watching football on Sunday, and I think the combination of Phoenix watching football and Buhari calling the Super Eagles appears to have led to our defeat.
But we had a day mourning the defeat yesterday, so we're only coming together today.
Yeah, so we're back now, and we have two guests. Our first guest is Samuel. Samuel is a policy analyst at the International Budget Partnership. And our second guest is Dr. Uche Igwe. He's a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics. Now, we're going to be discussing four topics. Firstly, we'll be discussing reports that the excess crude account has been depleted. Secondly, we'll be discussing reports as well that fuel prices are likely to be increased. And thirdly, we'll discuss the rice pyramids that were launched by President Buhari. And finally, we'll discuss the state of the Nigerian economy. There's news reports that the World Bank said the economy today is worse than it was 10 years ago. So firstly, to Phoenix, I was reading the newspaper reports say that the excess crude account, which Goodluck Jonathan left for Buhari, that had billions in it, now has only about $35 million. Is this correct, Phoenix?
Hello, Michael. And thanks, Atiku and Uche, for joining us this week. Hello, listeners. Well, that's what the National Executive Council told us that, in their report, that basically the balance of funds at this point in time is 30-something odd million dollars, which I think most people reacted to in shock. But it had been trending this way for a while. I remember a similar report was this sometime in the second half of last year saying they had about $72 million or something. For perspective, and for those who may not have followed as closely, Michael was alluding to was, of course, the excess crude oil account has been in place for quite a period of time now. I would say since 2003 or 2004. I'm sure Atiku can correct me if I'm wrong. But as at 2015, when the current administration came into office, it was about $2.1 billion. So what we've seen is a significant depletion of the excess crude account. Now, bearing in mind that before 2015, it had its ups and downs. We had gone from a high of about 20 billion, if I remember correctly, around 2008, 2009, around just before the global financial crisis. And then, of course, it dipped significantly during the global financial crisis, where Nigeria weathered the storm because we had that buffer. Dropped about 4 point something, went up a bit again, and then by the tail end of the Goodluck Jonathan presidency, it had come down to about 2 billion. Now, from a mechanics perspective, essentially to explain what the excess crude account is, essentially what it means is that Nigeria's oil proceeds to manage the budget. And this was something that Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala and her team at the time had proposed and put in place, was to say that, look, instead of letting your budget react to the vagaries of the oil prices, have an oil price benchmark. And if we have a windfall, if oil prices are above that benchmark, then move the excess money that is earned into the excess crude account. And so when they set the benchmark for the budget for the year, in the years that we had significant rise in prices, of course, the money kept being kept in that account. And of course, that's why you saw it go as high as 20 billion. We had that crisis, as I said before, and then we had the political issues around governors saying that the federal government was dipping its hands into the funds, wanted it shared, it got shared. And that's why it was depleted up to 2 billion. But I say that all, and we'll go into a debate. I say that all because we've also seen that in recent times, over the last, at least over the last 2 to 3 years, we've seen that our oil benchmark price in the budget has been lower than the actual average price of oil for each year. So there is no reason why the depletion should have continued. You should have had money accruing to the excess crude account, but we haven't seen that happen. And so this government is preparing to hand over in a much worse state to its successor government in a year and a few months' time. So that's the state of that excess crude account as we have now.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Dr. Igwe. Dr. Igwe, Phoenix has talked about the fact that a number of governors in Nigeria, in fact, led by Rotimi Amaechi at the time, as well as Bautini Fashola, demanded that the money in the account should be shared because they said it was unconstitutional for the federal government to be saving money on behalf of all the states, so they should share the money. Now, looking back, or now that we are in a situation where there's literally nothing left in the account, do you think that was politically wise of the likes of Amaechi and Fashola to call for the emptying of the account? Dr. Igwe, we can't hear you. Are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Good evening, by the way, everyone, and especially the listeners, and also my co-commentators, and you, the moderator. I think what is critical is to interrogate what reasons the governors gave at that time for the sharing, and also to be able to interrogate what reasons that the Federal Executive Council and the federal government would have given for the depletion. Is this as a result of profligacy or as a result of the exigencies in the economy? For instance, what happened during the pandemic and the fact that the oil prices, and I like the way it is called an excess crude account, that is also to cushion oil prices when oil prices go down. And if you recall, and without being on any side, it's important for us to note that during year 2020, the oil prices went to negative. So it is important to begin to ask what happened. What did the federal government do in terms of having to fund the budget when we all know that the revenue that the federal government depends on comes principally from oil? So it is that understanding that would place us in a better position to say whether the governors were right or whether the depletion was the right thing. Mm-hmm. So it is important we have the complete picture of what happened. And I think it's also crucial in speaking about the economy without being defensive to say that what has happened in the Nigerian economy is also a global thing. The pandemic was a global phenomenon. And for a country like ours that is dependent on a commodity like oil, the pandemic hit oil prices so badly. So I don't think it is unexpected that our economy will be in a bad shape or would have been in a worse shape than it was when the pandemic was not around the corner. But this is not to excuse the fact that there is a need for a deft economic management, and looking at the fact that Nigeria has now been, you know, reportedly designated as the global capital of poverty. So those are important things to look at, and it is only when we have that clarity that we can be able to take a position about whether the governors were right or wrong. In the long run, I think that there is a need to look at the pathway, design a concrete pathway towards recovery. And something that was depleted can be replenished So there needs to be a forward-thinking approach towards replenishing the excess crude account. And I also think that the whole conversation around complete removal of subsidies, around energy transition, around NNPC being the most profitable company in Africa, as the DMD of NNPC said, all those pieces of information can offer opportunities to replenishing the excess crude account. Whether that can be achieved in the next few months that are still remaining for this administration remains a subject of conversation. I'll rest it there for now.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe. I just want to get some clarity on your response. I just want you to clarify one issue. So are you saying that you don't know if it was a good idea for Fashola and Amaechi to call for the depletion of the account? Is that what you're saying? You don't know?
No, I am saying that it is important to... They did call for the sharing, but it is also important to understand why the depletion happened. On face value, you would say if they had called for the sharing and eventually the money got depleted, in quote, they could be justified. But I'm saying that without accepting that hook, line, and sinker, can we interrogate the reasons behind the depletion?
Sorry to cut you, Dr. Igwe. I said my question to you is, based on what you know, in a sort of yes or no answer, do you think that it was that they managed the funds appropriately? If you don't, you can also say you don't know, or do you know, or do you not know?
I don't know, because they have not provided the information to us. It is when they provide the details of the expenditure that we can make an informed judgment about whether they were right or wrong in the expenditure. But I also want to say that the governors who called for the sharing would have been justified if the excess crude account was mismanaged. That's my take.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe.
Just for me to understand, before we go on to Atiku, because I don't understand this point about if it was mismanaged. Mismanaged by who? In what period? The governors who called for the sharing called for it in the period between 2011 and 2015. So are you saying it was mismanaged then, or you're saying that if it was mismanaged between 2015 and now?
Yes, the depletion, so-called, happened obviously between 2015 and now.
Correct.
And I'm saying that with hindsight, you would say, maybe they were justified, but we can only arrive at that conclusion when we have the facts about what happened to the money. We need to follow them. Was it spent as a result of the exigencies of the economy triggered by the global pandemic?
No, but the government has given us... No, but the government has tried to explain away why the funds were depleted. I mean, Tolu Ogunlesi, who speaks on behalf of the president, gave us a breakdown saying $1 billion went into buying 12 Super Tucano, 2 went into Paris Club refunds, 3 was invested into, part of it was invested into Sovereign Wealth Fund. There's nothing there that speaks about pandemic support or because there was a pandemic. So clearly, the pandemic has nothing to do with the depletion of the excess crude account. And to your earlier point about the oil price going to a negative, obviously that was a point in time. If we take the whole full calendar year of 2020, Nigeria clearly made revenue from oil, and it was above the budget benchmark because the budget benchmark.
Let me ask you a question. Do you think that spending money to purchase Super Tucano at the time when we are threatened by terrorism was the right thing?
No, I don't think so. And I've said that several times. Okay, we haven't seen the import of the... Have we seen... I mean, we're 5 years down the line. We haven't seen any impact of the Super Tucano on the terrorism issue. Was that the best use of $1 billion in Nigeria?
Let me ask a question.
Sorry. Let me have to cut this because... we need to bring in Atiku, and we don't have time. So let me bring in Samuel. Samuel, you've heard the back and forth exchange between Phoenix and Dr. Igwe. So in your view, Samuel, this is your specialism, budgeting and financing by federal and state governments. So in your view, has the money in the excess crude account, which is now depleted, has the money been managed properly, Samuel?
Well, I think the results are there when you closely look at all key indicators as to whether the funds had been managed effectively. But just for context, I will say before the pandemic in 2019, as a Q4 of 2019, the balance in the SS crude account was barely, I think, about $459 million. Yeah, about $459 million. That's before the pandemic. I recall in that in 2015, we're about $2.1 billion or thereabouts. So the depletion actually did happen between 2015, 2016, 2017, and 2018. And just to also quickly add that during that period also, recall that there was aggressive monetization of deficit. Essentially, the central bank was equally printing money as at that time. Then there's this debt refund, which the federal government got, state government got, local government got also. So I ask the question, who is refunding who? If you're refunding somebody, is it that the federal government is refunding the state, or the state is refunding the federal government, or the state and the federal government refunding local government? But that did not happen. They just call it Paris Club refund, and everybody took a bite out of that. So there were a lot of complexity around what happened during that period. But just to your question, Michael, I think it's very clear. Look closely at the key indicator, and I can give it to you. Ogun State, you go to Ogun State. In Ogun State today, they have only 206 midwives. In a pandemic, 206 midwives in the whole of the state, almost 4 million people, right? Virtually all primary healthcare centers are dead in that look. In that state. I'm very, very specific now. You go to Lagos State, we could talk about the condition of infrastructure in Lagos State. The transportation system that they claim they want to invest in is an eyesore. There's no tracking device on the transportation system they claim they are doing. Most of the buses that they brought in are now rickety. It's dead. You take a step, you live there, you go to the southeast, it's a body of, you could go on and on and on. The key indicator is the economy did not grow during that period. The revenue of states were actually tanking during that same period. Key economic indicators, from socioeconomic indicators to wealth metrics, to every metrics you could measure, were actually descending. Of course, we are going backwards, right? And even if we are maintaining the same level, if you leave that space and then you look at the perception of people about Nigeria, investment, we are living outside, we are rolling out of the country. So it's a big mess itself. We don't need to look closely at the Ketu and say, oh, this is black. Let's be very clear here. It was a clear waste of resources. And in terms of the expenditure efficiency itself, let's be very clear. Lagos State, I always tell people that Lagos State, the cost of maintaining the office of the governor of Lagos State is higher than the cost of maintaining the office of the president of Nigeria. That shows clearly that something is fundamentally wrong. If you go to Port Harcourt, River State, the cost of maintaining the office of Amaechi is ridiculously more expensive than even maintaining some MDAs.
Amaechi is still the governor?
When he was calling for those, the white papers are there for everybody to see. So I think clearly, so that I don't begin to go directly at people, the same people that call for these funds to actually be spent, remember in 2016 when they were appointed ministers, by 2017, they started making comments that they don't have funds. In fact, Amaechi made some comments a few weeks ago complaining bitterly that the funds that they left in, was it Amaechi that was making that comment, that the funds that the GEJ government left to them could actually not run anything or something like that? It's actually an aberration. It's actually a policy somersault. let's be very clear here. The funds were mismanaged. This is where we are now. Then, building on that also, I think it's also important to think through the process of even looking closely at the SS Crude account. The SS Crude account is predicated on price. Historically, Nigeria is always under budget, right? Our projections for oil price has always been lower than the the actual price itself, meaning that there's always a gap. So decisions not to pull funds into that fund, it's based on many metrics. And more importantly, I think it's the volume. We typically say, oh, we are going to produce 2.6 million barrels, 2.4 million barrels. We never do that. We barely do 1.6, 1.4 million barrels of crude oil. So why do we have a metric for saving for the future, when that entire metric is actually a big, I'll call it, is actually not even coercive. I mean, it takes logic to actually put one and one together to get to. But the clear truth is that, the truth about Nigeria is that the metric for saving that other people had used and work for them in Nigeria is actually not. So the political will to push funds into that, to push funds into the SS Crude account is not there. Remember the tooth and nail that we fought to actually set up the sovereign wealth fund. Most of this state government actually did grandstand. Now it is the SS Crude. In fact, when you say the balance now in the fund is this amount, it's actually interest accrued on the funds on the savings that is actually even raising the funds. It's not as if government is putting ₦1 into the fund. If you look at 2020, you can go on the budget office website and you look at the column for SS Crude account. You see actual funds that had gone into that fund in the last 3 years is zero. It's actually interest coming from existing investment that is actually even what we are seeing today. I think let me rest my case here.
Thank you, Samuel, for clarifying the issues. Now we must move on to our next topic, which concerns fuel prices. The newspaper reports that the National Economic Council, chaired by the Vice President and with all the governors as members, recommended an increase in the price of petrol. It used to be 165, or it is 165 naira on average per litre across the country, and they've recommended that it should be increased to 302 naira, which is part of their plans to deregulate the petroleum sector. I understand that there have been threats of protests, and the government has decided to temporarily shelve the idea until further notice. Now, firstly, to Phoenix. Phoenix, we've been on this podcast for a number of years now, I'm sure, and there always seems to be one report or the other, one announcement by the government that they've removed the fuel subsidy and now they're deregulating the price of petrol. But every few months, there'll be another announcement about the same thing. So what is going on? Is it that they've been lying to us all this while? They've never actually deregulated? Or what exactly is the issue? What are the issues, Phoenix?
Well, Michael, long story short is, no, they never actually deregulated or removed subsidy. Every time we saw that, it was always a one step forward, two steps back type thing. I mean, there has been a considerable lack of will to correct the issues, and to the detriment of the government. We see the deficit every year. We see the debt explosion that we've had. And it all trails back to the subsidy expense that the government carries, that they've some way tried to, find some dodgy accounting to hide it under an NPC. But what it then means is that the revenue that flows from the NPC into the Federation coffers has been limited. But the point is, the government has refused to remove subsidy. Now, in the budget that they presented this year, they said they had made a provision for the removal of subsidy in the second half of the year, and they were mooting an idea of doing direct cash transfers to the most vulnerable in the society. to alleviate, I mean, having to remove it and increase the prices. Of course, in a year such as this, most intelligent watchers said that it was not going to happen because, I mean, this is we're in the season of politics. I mean, we're in the run-up into the general elections in the first quarter of next year. The ruling party, with the understanding that their current leader, the president, cannot run again, and therefore they need all the goodwill that they can to succeed at the polls. So they were never going to allow in that same year to rock the boat and have the people be up in arms. So you see, the thing for me is you have 7 years of goodwill that have been wasted, because all throughout, when this government came in on the back of, you know, we're coming in to deal with, you know, fight corruption, fix the economy and all of that, they had ample chances, ample opportunities to fix this fuel subsidy, oil price issue, you know, be done with it. But it became a problem that continued to compound itself, because they were knowing fully well that almost every drop of fuel that we use in Nigeria is imported. The games that they played with FX kept devaluing the naira, which obviously made oil prices higher. Petrol prices higher in terms of, you know, importing back into the country. Now, that has gotten exacerbated in recent times with the pandemic and the supply chain crisis and all of those kind of issues that are driving up oil prices at the same time. So you have a double whammy where, of course, from a revenue receipts perspective, you're happy to see oil prices go up. But from a fuel perspective, as oil prices go up, petrol prices go up, and then your naira to dollar effect makes it more difficult. So it's blowing a huge hole in government finances, but it's opportunities that they've wasted and could not fix. And now, in a political season, you can clearly see the reluctance of the government to fix the issue. So it's going to remain this way. It's going to be a poison chalice for a new government to inherit, and then we see whoever comes in and what they're able to do.
Thank you, Phoenix. Dr. Igwe, the Nigerian government announced that in 2021, in the first 9 months, they paid $2.1 billion in fuel subsidies. Now, if you multiply that over the number of years this government has been in power, even if you say 6 years, for example, that's about $12 billion over that period. And this same government, or the members of this same government, fought the previous administration when President Goodluck Jonathan tried to remove the subsidy. In fact, President Buhari said there was no such thing as subsidy and called subsidy a fraud, but then came into office and the cost has ballooned. As you know, the excess crude account is empty. Nigerian government is facing a fiscal crisis, and even now they're still refusing to remove the subsidy. In your view, Dr. Igwe, is this evidence of sound economic management, firstly? So would you keep this subsidy, and is it a wise policy to have in the first place?
I think that the general idea of keeping subsidy and allowing it balloon and drain revenue is, in my view, postponing the doomsday. It is unsustainable, and it will be counterproductive in the long run. However, this is something that is fairly contentious, because for a very long time now, we have learned that one of the most sensitive aspects of governance in this country has to do with increment in the price, the pump price. So I think that it is important to balance the sensitivity of the issue and realistic economic decision making. And I think that whosoever is delaying it and trying to announce, fill the pause, is probably thinking, at what point would we continue to allow sensitivity, threats for protest, affect what we consider the right economic decision making take at this time? So I'm not in government, but I imagine from the feelers we get, that could be part of the reasons. But again, I do not want to talk about the issue of fuel subsidy removal and petroleum industry governance in general without speaking about the Petroleum Industry Act. With all its imperfections as it is currently, it is important to give this government credit for passing the Petroleum Industry Act after 20 years of perambulation. And I say this as someone who has followed the journey of the Petroleum Industry Act and who also understands that the Petroleum Industry Act, as is currently signed by Mr. President, has got contentious clauses and is imperfect. But for me, I think it is important that opening up the sector to competition, which is what removing fuel subsidy will achieve, creating that environment can only happen when there is an enabling legislation. And in my view, passing that imperfect legislation called Petroleum Industry Act is an important first step. Now, I want us to also understand that the petroleum sector has been the epicenter of patronage that this country has known for years before now. And I also think that reforming that sector will not happen overnight. So what I think we should do is to have a second look at it, look at the act that we now have, and look at the fact that the subsidy is unsustainable, and find a systematic way to remove the subsidy, maybe slowly, incrementally, without necessarily triggering inflation in people's homes, because immediately fuel prices are allowed to be dictated by, you know, the vagaries of the economy, it could so skyrocket that inflation will hit households and household income will be wiped off. So I think there's a need to look at all of this further and be able to know that the forward-looking way is to remove the fuel subsidy completely, especially looking at the global debates about energy transition. And maybe I have argued in other fora that we can actually find ways to invest these billions of dollars, you know, of fuel subsidy monies to other productive areas, you know, than like clean energy. Everybody is divesting into clean energy. Maybe we can put side by side a conversation about leveraging the energy transition conversation and our position as a country and our action as a country around energy transition, tie it systematically, the removal of fuel subsidy, so that it can make sense to a common man. That's my take.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe. Let me bring in Samuel. Samuel, Dr. Igwe, on the one hand, has said there may be political considerations given the emotional attachment as well as the financial consequences to ordinary Nigerians of the fuel subsidy. And then on the other hand, he says we should praise Mr. President for getting this Petroleum Industry Act passed, because it is one of the mechanisms by which we can even remove the subsidy. Do you agree with his analysis, Samuel?
I think it's a bag, or I think it's a mixed bag. I think the first thing is that, yes, the PIB that is now in vogue, the Petroleum Industry Bill itself, if it has failed in multiple places, at least I'm sure that you will agree with me that, you remember, I mean, just for context, Nigeria actually did set up the PPPRA to actually modulate price. They set up a full agency of government, and their job is just to calculate the price of PMS, just to use calculator. And that agency do have a big office. You have a lot of staff going in there. You have a big DG, which is Babariga, rolling around and rolling his stomach around. That's how inefficient the Nigerian government is. Who sets up an agency just to calculate the price of PMS, the landing cost? Something that I'm sure my seven-year-old son can actually do that on his computer. Only him alone can do that. So eliminating that big agency is actually a big plus for us. And I can say there are multiple agencies within government. So anytime I see things moving in that direction, at least it's important to applaud such initiative. But that said, the argument for removal of subsidy in Nigeria or not removing subsidy, it's skewed. It started way back in the 1970s. Now, just for context, 2021, the federal government of Nigeria alone will spend 1 trillion naira on non-regular allowance. Estaco of government and politicians, Estaco for government officials and politicians traveling abroad. And that same government will now come on air, speaking with multiple voices, right? Come on air and announce to Nigeria that 3 trillion naira as subsidy. It's an aberration that it's just too expensive. That tells you clearly that something is fundamentally wrong somewhere. The first thing is that why can't you clean your book first? Start doing the hard work internally where you could actually use just executive yet without people's pressure to remove some of those burdens. Non-regular allowance had jumped from less than 300 billion under the bad Jonathan government that was removed for corruption to almost 1 trillion. That's an aberration. That's a disgrace itself. Let's start from that conversation. If you can actually save that 1 trillion or even save 80% of that fund and replow it into infrastructure, that tells you that you are moving in the right direction. Or even maintain at Jonathan's level, they will say you are moving. So why would you want to take out how do you justify the fact that you want to take out 3 trillion from people's hands? That's one big question to ask. The second question is that Nigeria happens to be the only country in the world, of course, that does not have, we have about 52 cities in Nigeria, close to about, I think about 133, if I'm right, 133 townships. None, not even one, have an effective public transport system. Not one. If you go to Ghana, at least they have some. Let people look at Lagos and say BRT and all those things that they do in Lagos actually functioning, but it's actually a disgrace. So not one that you can actually even pioneer have that thing. So how do you redirect subsidy? If you say you want to take it out, and we're going to, and those arguments have been made over and over since 1970s. So my point there is that I think we don't have a government that is sincere that knows what they are doing. That's a fact. And as far as that conversation, I mean, yeah, I can come on there and say, well, I'm an economist. We need to remove subsidy. Sounds elitist. It sounds as if you're intelligent. But the fundamental principle on which you can actually convince the working poor and the have-nots in Nigeria to take away subsidy is absent in our system. And until we take that corrective measure, I Atiku Samuel cannot walk up to a poor man on the street and explain to him that subsidy is actually a problem. It's a problem that needs to be taken away until government takes direction. So I think let me close my argument there.
Thank you, Samuel. Now we must move on to our next topic, which is the rice pyramids launched by President Buhari. Phoenix, I'm struggling to understand because a number of people on social media raised the same issue and I too am struggling. What was the purpose behind this rice pyramid launch? Could you talk us through the issues, Phoenix?
Michael, this one I asked me, what was the purpose? I'm no Buhari spokesman now. I mean, as an outsider looking in, I thought it was one of those. So it was two things to me. One, it was an effort to show that our focus on agriculture and rice in particular, knowing fully well that from day one, they banned rice from coming in. They also closed borders and all of those kind of things. That the effort on pushing an agriculture, seeming agriculture agenda was bearing fruit. And then, of course, knowing Buhari as someone who stuck in the 60s and 70s, he obviously remembered the rice pyramids of his youth. The granite pyramids of his youth. And therefore, either he asked for that or somebody on his team thought he would find it amusing. And of course, he did find it amusing and thought it made sense in 2022. to be unveiling the rice pyramids in Nigeria. An interesting comment that I saw on Twitter was one from Professor Jibrin Ibrahim, who I think is chairman of the editorial board of Premium Times, who was pointing out, and I thought it was an interesting point because, I mean, it was also one of those historical lessons that you pick up on, who was saying that the granite pyramids were done while waiting for transportation to take them away. That these rice pyramids that were put up in Abuja, what were they waiting for? So what was the import of doing it? It's just part of the show of, you know, when you've mismanaged an economy to the degree that this government has, you clutch at straws and you look for certain things to send a symbol to your people that you're actually doing something that is yielding fruit. And people need to be prepared. There are going to be many of such symbols this year again, to the point I was making earlier, we're in the firmly in the political season. The APC needs to show to its followers that yes, it intends to retain power. And of course, this kind of symbolism is required for a government that, I mean, even to the blind and deaf man on the street knows, they all feel the pangs of the failure and the issues that people feel deeply. I mean, the sharp rise in inflation, the unemployment that we have at 33% as of the last time that it was counted, I think it was sometime last year. We've seen insecurity issues. We've seen so many things that have gone wrong. We've seen a debt pileup that is not commensurate with this level of development within the economy. I mean, 7 years in, we're still talking about 4,000 megawatts of electricity. Nothing has been done in that space, and even all of the talk of infrastructure, it's still quite a mirage. So for me, the need to send out positive signs, to send out symbols was what was outweighing good sense, and that was the reason why this was done.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Dr. Uche Igwe. Doctor, President Buhari boasts about his anchor borrower program and what he claims successful agricultural policy. But a number of the commentary on social media and the traditional media is on the fact that when the previous administration left office, a bag of rice was at around 6,000 and a half. And now a bag of rice is somewhere as high as 30,000 naira. Now, comparing the significant increase in a bag of rice since this government took office, can you describe their rice policy as a success, Dr. Igwe?
In clear context, and I like the way the earlier speaker spoke about context. There are several reasons that could lead to increment of price of a commodity like rice, apart from policy failure. While policy failure could be part of it, but I also want us to understand that there are very urgent insecurity issues in some of the areas that this rice are produced, or the areas that currently produce the rice. So I don't think that for instance, in the Southeast, there are so many commodities that you have to transport from one part of the country to the other. And with all of the Ghost Monday activities, you see prices skyrocket. So while it is important to say that it could be as a result of policy failure, I will be cautious in saying that. I would be able to say that insecurity is a major cause. Farmers' Hessman crisis that has escalated and has been politicized, and of course the full-blown terrorism, which is still has not been able, there has not been subdued so far by government efforts sufficiently from the kind of feedback we get. Some of those are important things to put on the table before coming to the conclusion about the prizes. Having said that, I think that there are concerns raised about the Anchor Borrowers Program, about the transparency, and at the fact that some people saw the money is given to them. The numbers of people who have been repaying the loan, and that tendency for some people to convert the loan as their own dividend of democracy. And also in looking at the policy, whether there were safeguards put in when some of those loans were designed and being disbursed. Those are important issues. And for me, the amount of increment is unacceptable, but it is also important to interrogate what the issues are without clearly passing a judgment that it is policy failure. It could be that there are other external factors like insecurity that could have contributed to some of these prizes. Access could be an issue with the bandits and all of that. So I think that we need to look at it thoroughly before. So I will not conclude about policy failure, but I think that obviously I would recommend policy improvement.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe. I need to ask a follow-up question because I'm trying to understand. Most democratic or well-governed countries in the world, a government takes responsibility for security and access to the roads and for supporting agriculture. Now, the Buhari administration is responsible for security. The Anchor Borrower program that you described as a failure is also their policy. They are also the ones in power who should provide security. So what I'm trying to understand is how then can you say you want to separate their role as being in charge of the country from the price of rice? All these are responsible factors for rice going up, but somehow you seem to be saying that it's not their responsibility. How do you reconcile those two?
No. You are misquoting me. It is the responsibility of government to provide security. And if insecurity continues to fester, it is important to put the blame on government. But what we talked about was not insecurity. Remember the question you asked me was about the increment in the price of rice and the Anchor Borrowers Program and the possibility that could lead to a conclusion that it is policy failure. And I want to state, and I would like to repeat again, that it can be as a result of other things, and insecurity could be part of it. Trying to say that or take away the responsibility from government, it will be coup d'etat. And you know what is happening in so many countries around Africa. So I don't want to be involved. Whether rice, whether agriculture, whether insecurity, government is a responsibility of government. And if one fails and affects the other, government should be held culpable. What I do not want to submit here that because there is inflation, because the price of rice has increased, that is because the Anchor Borrowers Program has failed colossally, or government policy in that regard was a wrong one. It could be an imperfect policy, but I'm saying that insecurity can be an exacerbating factor, disrupting access to farmers, and by so doing, making things so difficult that when farmers now get the rice, they want to make sure that they transfer all the pain on the consumers. And by so doing, the prices will rise. That's where we are. That's why we are. That's part of why we are where we are now. That's my submission.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe. Samuel, has government policy failed? And is that the reason for the price increase from 6,500 when it came into office to the about 30,000 naira we're seeing today for a bag of rice? Samuel.
I think it's clear. If we're using price as metric for measuring outcome, I think they failed blatantly. And I mean, just to recall, just going back memory lane, the first policy that this government came up with, recall, when they had to actually appoint ministers, was the de facto coordinating minister for the economy that gave himself that power, the central bank governor. Announced outright ban on sales of forex to importers of rice, and that led to the upshoot in the price of of rice. I say PMS. That is why the price of rice today is where it is, because of that policy failure. And that policy had been analyzed by leading scholars, the central bank's monetary policy itself. Its policy around Forex FX management had been analyzed repeatedly. We've looked at many indices, and the outcome had always pointed us in one direction, colossal failure. That's one. Two, in terms of the agricultural policy of this government, I think it is not clear whether they're actually doing handouts, they want to run a business. It's really not clear. The same government took a World Bank, they took a loan, went all the way to Brazil to talk about, to actually sweet talk about the need to actually bring mechanization into the country. Nothing has happened, but the loan, we keep paying interest on those loans, on that loan. I work with about 500,000, we support like 500,000 women farmers in Nigeria. And just for context, 70% of smallholder farmers in Nigeria are women. And if you talk to the 500,000 women, whether any of them have actually seen one benefit from the anchor borrowers program. I'm not talking about survey. You know, you could do survey of 5,000 farmers and draw conclusion. I'm talking about 500,000 women farmers across the 36 states in this country. Colossal failure. All of them actually point to one thing, that the anchor borrowers program is actually designed for what they call political farmers. You could actually walk up to government, give them one big story, go to one farm, take pictures, and you get loan disbursed into your account. As at last count, they were saying that about 5 million people got loans to do what in particular. Let's put that aside. During the heart of the pandemic, where we plant rice in Nigeria, the Niger region, around the Niger belt itself, around the Loni Okeogun axis, there was infestation. There's this armyworm that was taking out most of these cereal products, from rice to maize and all those things. The crop protection products that they should have distributed, remember there was lockdown, farmers could not access market and all those things. All those things were left in warehouse until virtually all those products, all the produce actually got destroyed. And you know, after that time, after doing an assessment, the president himself sacked and fired the minister for agriculture at that time. After assessment. So why do you fire somebody if your policy had been working? So the president himself admitted when he fired his minister of agriculture that the last, how will I call it now, his policy had failed blatantly. So to conclude on this matter, the core problem with Nigeria agricultural, the why price of agricultural produce in Nigeria is actually relatively higher, and why imports become a magnet. Nigeria continues to be a magnet for food imports. It's simple. You have small farms scattered everywhere. There's no thinking around how do you leverage, we know we have small farmers, people playing on 2 acres of land, 3 acres of land. It's ridiculous. We can't move on in that perspective. So if you look at the economic development plan, they still continue to anchor on that. Oh, we are going to create jobs in the agricultural sector. Who does that? It's an aberration. And we need to stop all this wishful thinking. Less than 1 million person in this country could actually cultivate all our lands and then we move on. So there's no job in agriculture for anybody. It's a bloody lie. We should drop that lie and put it somewhere else and focus on other things. As long as government continue to look at agriculture and say they will create jobs. So what they are saying in essence is that everybody, you'll be given 2 acres of land to be cultivating, to make jobs. How do you even make ends meet? Those farms, when they produce things, how do you even aggregate product together? A cost of maize to actually put corn together, aggregating corn together, in Ilorin alone, to pull them together alone is ridiculously more expensive. The logistical cost is more expensive than just going outside and bringing it in. So all those things, the value chain itself, there's no clear-cut thinking. I think in ending that, the moment you see that picture of that pyramid, it depletes a complete failure. It's a complete disaster. How do governments carry back resources with borrowed money? Remember, we are borrowing money. Bag paddy rice. It's not even milled rice. Bag them, ship them with trailers to Abuja, burn. I think let me end my case here.
Thank you, Samuel, for setting out the issues. You clearly believe that this was a policy failure by the Buhari government. But on to our final topic, which is there's a report in the People's Gazette which claims that the World Bank has released a report highlighting the fact that Nigeria's economy, as at today under the Buhari administration, is worse off than it was 10 years ago. The report is called the Global Economic Prospect for 2022. Phoenix, is this correct that the economy is worse today than it was over 10 years ago? And is this Buhari's fault, or is the pandemic responsible for the state of Nigeria's economic situation?
I think it's no gain saying, and you don't need a World Bank report to tell you that the economy is in a much worse state than it was 10 years ago. I mean, we're talking about 2012 versus 2022, and I mean, by all metrics, by all indices, unemployment, inflation, the government debt levels, the impact on lives and of the people, poverty levels, name it, by every index that you want to measure, I mean, it's clear that we're in a worse place. To your question about, is it Buhari's fault or the pandemic? I mean, for me, I mean, as much as Buhari supporters would like to conveniently blame the pandemic, let's not forget that there was a recession under Buhari even before we had a pandemic. Let's not forget that the unemployment was already taking a bad turn even before the pandemic. Let's not forget that the Naira had significantly lost value compared to where it was when he came in before the pandemic. Let's not forget that he also, I mean, as Atiku was mentioning, some of those policies that were done from the very beginning, the 41 items banned by the central bank, which was obviously leaning towards Buhari's policies, the closure of land borders, name it. So there are things that were already in play, and there was a trajectory that you could clearly measure of the economy under Buhari before the pandemic hit. Of course, it is expected that the pandemic will exacerbate the issue, would make it worse, but that's not to say that we're not already in a more difficult situation. And really, when they try to blame the pandemic, I wonder truly, because Nigeria did not go into severe lockdowns as with most of the countries in the West. Nigeria continued to remain open, continue to do business. So how much of the pandemic really hit? Of course, we know that because we're so reliant for government revenues on oil proceeds, yes, there was an impact. But did the government stop spending? No, it continued to reel out unrealistic budgets and to borrow heavily to fund them. So the government did not stop its business. The government did not tighten its belt to say, oh, we're in the middle of a pandemic. We need to be more mindful and we need to bring in some austerity measures in terms of government spending and be more choiceful about where you put the nation's scarce resources. We didn't see that. So there was clear economic control. It's just that, I mean, the poor outcomes are a reflection of the lack of capacity and the economic mismanagement that we've seen. So if anybody asks me why is the Nigerian economy in the doldrums? Why have we struggled for the last 6 to 7 years? I mean, I blame that squarely on Buhari and his team and how they have totally mismanaged the country's economy and brought us to the situation we're in, where across every index, I mean, foreign direct investment, I mean, name it. I mean, Nigeria has taken several steps back from where it was, even when it was still trying to find its feet. I mean, we were in a much better place than we are today.
Thank you, Phoenix. Let me bring in Dr. Igwe. Dr. Igwe, Phoenix has just set out the state of the economy. The report, the news report, has also said the same thing. And the question for you is this: a number of young people in 2015 looked up to the likes of Rodney Amaechi, Babatunde Fashola, Kaude Fayemi, who told them that the previous government had failed on the economy and that they were coming into power with Buhari to transform Nigeria. Instead, as Phoenix and the report have highlighted, on every index or measure, they have made things worse. So the question is, how do you, or how do those men explain themselves to the Nigerian people? Or how would an Amaechi, for example, who we hear has presidential ambitions, how is he going to sell himself when the person he brought into office has been a total disaster? Dr. Igwe.
You mentioned Amaechi, Fashola, and Fayemi. And let me say that while I have a lot of respect for the three gentlemen you mentioned, I do not represent any one of them. And as an individual, I also had a lot of faith in the government led by President Buhari at that time, because we had concerns, especially about the security situation and the level of corruption on the economy and all of that. I will say that, like every Nigerian, I've been impacted directly and indirectly by some of these economic policies and the impact on many of us. They are far from perfect. But again, I want to say that these individuals there are a couple of things that have not necessarily gone very badly. And if you want to sort of unpack the three persons you talked about, the part of the things that this government, again, imperfectly can speak boldly about is about the issues in the transportation sector or subsector, depending on who describing, and the fact that some describe them as locomotives, some describe them, I mean, there are sort of complaints we all get, but today you can leave worry and you can come to Itakpe by train. And today, if you leave Ibadan by train, by the way, I went to school there, and you can come to Lagos. And if you leave Abuja, you can come to Kaduna. These things are imperfect developments, but they are positive, especially if you look at the fact that for so many years, in fact, children who were born 20 years ago probably never saw a train, a functional one. And there's also a lot of work going on in the roads, a lot of construction. And somebody who said the second Niger Bridge is not yet complete, but there are a couple of things going on. Now, are they sufficient to impact on the economy, impact on unemployment, and impact on poverty? No, they are not. And is it possible to say that on all fronts, this government has been a fatal failure? I don't think so. But would you say that expectations did not match reality. Yes, we had a whole lot of expectations. And, you know, the way we saw our president at that time when he was contesting, we thought that he would come in and do, permit me to use the word magic. But, you know, when you come in and see the reality on ground, you may, you know, the dynamics may be quite different. And there are so many other things that might have contributed. Like I said, I don't work for government. I'm not a spokesperson of government. But things have not been as we expected. Would you lay the blame on the doorstep of these three individuals? That will be unfair if you do so. But were they part of the people who inspired other young people to support this government? Yes. And do they need to have part of the blames? Yes. Now, I don't know about the presidential ambition of the person you talked about, but the three persons you mentioned are Nigerians. And if they think they can improve on things and they think that they want to run for the highest office on the land, of the land, I think, you know, they are citizens of Nigeria. The last time I checked, Rotimi Amaechi, Babatunde Fashola, and Mr. Kayode Fayemi, or Dr. Kayode Fayemi, they are all Nigerians, and the last time I checked, they have a right to contest for the highest office. What they will explain to Nigerians is entirely their business. And what we would say is that let us watch and see. But I do not think that any right-thinking person, be the person a politician or an ordinary person like me, would desire any other thing more than improvement. Whatever message anybody, any political party will give Nigerians that will resonate, that message must address insecurity, that message must address unemployment, that message must bring in clear actions that will stimulate the economy and take us slightly away from where we're headed at the moment.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe, for that. I need to slightly pin you down on this issue because I know that you are an admirer of Rotimi Amaechi. And this is a man who led Buhari's campaign twice in 2015 and in 2019, despite all the insecurity and economic mismanagement going on. And from what you're saying, you seem to be implying that somehow, because we have some trains that we're running, he has done well. So in your view, has Rotimi Amaechi done enough to be a serious candidate for president? Do you think, despite his support for this Buhari administration, he's the kind of person who should be president of Nigeria?
My answer to this is a yes. Rotimi Amaechi is eminently qualified to be the president of Nigeria. And he just served as a minister. And when people assess him, I would want people to assess him based on his record. He was a governor and chief executive of a state for 8 years, and his footprints across the educational sector, across the infrastructure sector, across the health sector, they remain indelible in River State. Now, as a minister, he is a staff of the president. I think that position limits whatever he can do. He can only act on delegated authority. Based on what has been delegated to him, I want to also say without equivocation that he has performed. So if tomorrow Rotimi Amaechi indicates that he will run for the highest office in the land, he will get my support.
Thank you, Dr. Igwe. Now let me bring in Atiku. Atiku, you heard the conversation with Dr. Igwe. He says, whilst yes, the economy might be bad, some other things have done well. He's talked about the railway sector, for example, saying how you can now get trains from Ibadan to Lagos, from Warri to Itakpe, and there's the Abuja-Kaduna rail. When you weigh these up and then compare the economic cost in terms of unemployment, insecurity, as well as inflation, would you say it was worth it? And do any of the individuals who brought this government into power, do you think they're qualified or should be considered for the presidency of Nigeria in 2023? Samuel.
I think this is a very difficult question, but very straight. I think it's important to say quickly that people talk so much about the Great Depression in America. The Great Depression, that people were actually committing suicide. You see children, 7-year-old, 5-year-old kids, holding placard begging for bread on the streets of America. And that forced a lot of policy shifts and changes. And today we still read about the Great Depression. Just for context, during the Great Depression, 15 million Americans lost their jobs. As of 2015, when the Buhari, the Amechi, the Fashola-led government came into power, Nigerians had 52 million full-time jobs. Before the pandemic, Q1 of 2020, that number had gone down to 32 million. They've essentially killed about 18 to 24 million full-time jobs. That alone should stop them all. In fact, in a sane society, they should not even hold any office again. That's the aberration, the poor management. These people sit at council deliberating about what? The fact that they killed 18 million jobs with irrational decision-making, senseless policies. And then they come on TV and then they smile that they are building railway. Who built this kind of railway? This railway had been built in the 1915s. Who cares about this railway? How many people ply the railway? In fact, there's not even an electronic ticketing system. How many people run on that railway that they are talking about? Aside from that, they are not even responsible for building the railway in the first call. This is actually a China-made product that is financed by China, bankrolled by China, built by China personnel. All we did was just to sign some papers, right? We signed some papers and then boom. Then the Chinese came in, and then, of course, if you look closely at the Nigerian debt paper, you notice that the debt to finance those railway were not actually even part of our external debt. They're actually somewhere else, meaning that Chinese could actually take over that railway. Away from the railway, let's talk about the airport system. It's an aberration. You can move around and see what is happening. Go to Abuja, the Abuja airport system. And then you notice that the cost itself initially would have been $1 billion. That $1 billion had gone to $2 billion because of, again, policy issues shifting ABCD. We can go on and on and on like that. Amechi himself abandoned the entire Southeast. I mean, we don't need to call, let's call Ketu Black and then Port Black. Abandoned the entire Southeast, the South-South, begin to make irrational argument that you need to construct a railway to Niger Republic. Who does that? Even if Buhari is telling you that as a minister of transportation, aren't you supposed to be very logical? But he came on air smiling and telling Nigerian, making a very valid argument, deceiving Nigerians that this is actually a sensible economic policy. Who takes a loan? What's the GDP of Niger Republic that will warrant Nigeria building an infrastructure in that space where key things that should be done in this economy have been abandoned? My conclusion is this. These people had failed, and I'm happy that, if you notice closely, you notice that Fashola himself had actually taken the back seat. He's no longer talking because he had admitted himself that he has failed. Although he may not say it publicly, but the fact that he's no longer ranting and talking again and making big arguments, calling the power sector, ABC, the way he was ranting during Jonathan's tenure, that power stations are actually constellations of I better pass my neighbor, packed in one building to power this thing. He has not increased generation. He has not increased anything. So you could look at these people, they failed by all metrics. But above all, the most important indices upon which fractional reserve banking that predicates and actually determine the kind of economic system we run today is on employment, they failed. How do you lose 18 million full-time jobs before a pandemic within a space of how many years? You know how, what it takes to create 10 million jobs? That is my metrics for measuring these people. And there's no way these people, there's nothing they can say. In fact, if you vote for them, I'm sorry. These people are going there. In fact, we have 32. By the time they are done, maybe we have less than 5 million jobs. I rest my case there.
Thank you, Atiku, for providing an interesting counterpoint to Dr. Igwe. So you think they failed and don't qualify for the presidency, and Dr. Igwe doesn't think so. Let me give the final word to Phoenix before we close. Phoenix, will you be joining the campaign train of Rotimi Amaechi when he declares?
I don't think there's anything else to add to what Atiku has said. I mean, numbers don't lie, and what he has provided are clear facts. I mean, for me, whenever I think about Nigeria, even over the last 10 years, it's always been about the economy. Because when you have a country of, whether you want to say 150 or 180 million people, when we have a population that is increasing by 3% every year, you know that the economy has to be your focus. It's the same way China looks at the economy, even though and manage the economy different from how they manage their political space. It's the same way India focuses on the economy. You have such a large population, you cannot afford to have the kind of situation we've had over the last 7 years, to lose 8 years, which is almost a lifetime for a lot of people. There are children who or young Nigerians who have lost almost a decade of their lives and have been set back. I think who is talking about a loss of 20 million jobs. This is a country that should be creating, if you're having 3% population growth, and we're saying that to match that, we should be maybe increasing jobs by 3% every year. So essentially, we should have been creating between 1 to 2 million jobs every year. And so for the last 8 years, we should have maybe created 15 to 16 million jobs. Instead, we lost 20 million jobs. So add that. So essentially, what you've lost is about 30 to 35 million jobs. Where do you even begin to come back? And then people want to reward failure. I'm not one to do that. Never. I'm somebody who is very performance driven. And to say that anybody who's been a part of this government, a minister, a member of the Federal Executive Council, who sits in those deliberations, and then say that, oh, you are limited, you are, but in the portfolio they gave you, where are the results? Who cares about entering train from Warri to Itakwe? Who cares? What is happening there? We know the corridors where their economic activity is in this country. What has been done to open that up? The key places, we're seeing somebody going to build a train to Maradi in Niger. How much economic activity happens there? The east-west corridor, what has been done to open that up? We've been talking about ports. They're finally, celebrating a private enterprise on a deep sea port. They're waiting for Dangote to finish his refinery. Meanwhile, you see all the borrowings that have been done, and you see no impact on the economy. These people have been a part of this economy. In as much as we blame Buhari as the figurehead, and yes, indeed, he is the leader of the government, but nobody should be able to walk away from this last 7, going on 8 years of disaster and claim that, oh, we were just working for Buhari. We were not. No, it is collective failure, collective, especially to the level at which this country has seen a regression, a significant backward movement. We didn't have Nirvana before. Nobody, make no mistake about it. We're not in a fantastic place. But the level to which we have dropped is so significant, and the loss is going to be felt for generations to come. So we cannot reward that failure by letting the same characters come up and say that they want to run for office. And no, Nigerians have to show that they deserve better, and they should get better. So they need to look forward to other people.
Thank you, Phoenix. Our time is up, but once again, I must thank our two guests. Thank you, Dr. Igwe, and thank you, Samuel Atiku, for taking time out to be here. Thank you, Phoenix, for co-hosting this podcast with me. And finally, thank you to our loyal listeners for always giving us helpful feedback. So until same time next week, I wish you all a fantastic 7 days.
Thank you, Michael. And thank you, Che and Atiku, for joining us. Thank you, listeners, again, for being with us. And wish you a great rest of the week. Bye, everyone.